So what we're going to do now is we've got the questions that you all asked, and we are going to talk about these for maybe 8 minutes or so, 10 minutes. And then we're going to hear from you all via Gail, the themes, and then we'll come back and sort of and wrap it up. Because we only have the clock says 10, then we're going to try to run this a little more like, I don't know if you've ever seen the ESPN show Pardon the Interruption, but you know, try to keep your answers short. If I had a little buzzer, I'd be ringing it when you go on too long. Let's start with the question that I sort of raised at the end there, which is related to the question here, which is, what do you think the role of the state, of governments in creating climates that are more welcoming to SMEs? What's the role that the state should play? And as a corollary to that, can you really make SMEs work in an environment where the state is hostile, where you are paying 87% in tax or whatever it is, or where the state barely exists?
I think the state, I hate the word the state, it has the implication of, you know.
Okay, the government. What's the government's role?
Our Cold War. The government. I think it's absolutely critical. I mean, the whole SBA in the United States, which then was translated to Mexico, and I even worked in the Dominican Republic, and I worked in Africa 20 years ago about creating those kind of institutions. I think the state is important. It can create the right tax incentives. It can create the right environment. It can have legal systems, enforcement systems, and it can be frankly, it's the tone at the top. If the tone at the top, whoever's leading a country, talks about entrepreneurism and says, you know, we want to encourage people to build businesses and build businesses of the future, I think that has an enormous impact on like a role model.
Right. Okay. Bert, what do you think?
I think the best thing, most of my entrepreneurs, they would love the state just to, you know, what is that prayer? You know, God keep the czar long away, far away from us. I mean, you know, I absolutely want to agree with what Alan is saying. On the other hand, it isn't even necessary that they do all that panoply of sophisticated mechanisms. Many states don't necessarily have the money to do that. What's necessary, though, is that they understand that private sector has to grow. They have to let it grow. They have to, I mean, it's difficult when health inspectors come in for a bribe, veterinarian guys come in for a bribe. You know, the corruption is a big issue. And I think that the IFIs or the World Bank, they need to understand that. They need to understand that there are incentives. Obviously, from our perspective, how can we help incentivize? We ought to praise governments who do a good job. We ought to make sure that people are aware of how important that part is as a democracy or in terms of helping the lives of citizens, and praise those people, again, who do it. So you have a negative and a positive. Too often, I think our actions are predicated on what can we tell them to do. You know, sometimes what we ought to do is to find out what it is that they're doing that's good and really push them out in that direction, because there's probably cultural reasons why they're doing that. So that's not to take anything away from Alan.
Sure.
What I'm saying is that sometimes maybe from a practitioner's point of view, if I can talk about what we've done in Uzbekistan and Bulgaria, et cetera, it's really trying to find those government people, praise them for leaving us alone.
You know, can I give you a very interesting – let me give you a practical example. I went to Egypt about a year or two ago, and in Cairo there is a building, a big building, and on the top of it, in big letters in English, one-stop shop. And what they did is they took all the 35 ministries that you had to go through to get – to improve the process, and you can stay in one building and finish everything.
Right.
I took that idea back to the president of Nigeria. Nigeria introduced it. I met yesterday with a minister of finance from Rwanda and said they're doing it. Those are the ways you – eliminate the toll booths that people have to go through to get business done.
Well, that's obviously, I mean, one of the big challenges that, I mean, Hernando de Soto talks about in terms of how long it takes to actually just set up a business, let alone all the other kinds of problems. One interesting question here is someone asks, who is best situated to catalyze the changes you're advocating? I don't know who the you is. Maybe Sonal? I don't know. You're advocating in the financial system. If it takes a partnership, and that is, say, a partnership between the various kinds of players, how can that be initiated? Let's put the question this way. Is there one part of the kind of value chain, if you think about it in terms of venture capital, equity investors, government subsidies, whatever it is, that can act alone or should go first? Or is this kind of everybody needs to work together? I mean, are explicit partnerships necessary for this to really take off?
I think partnerships help. And in some cases, things that we can do are, you know, with a fund like Allen's or working with others, we can make investments in those funds. And a name like Google in some countries goes a long way because it catalyzes more investment coming in. If somebody puts in, Rockefeller or anybody else puts in, it helps with that. It helps also in terms of the regulatory side. We can also do a lot of the funding on the regulatory side that a fund is not going to have time to do, but that's something that we can certainly help with or fund along the side of or use our commitments in different ways of doing that. With banks, we can be the risk takers. We can put in the money that allows the risk aspect. I know there's a question here regarding, you know, what corporations have to meet the shareholder needs. What
right.
do they do? The question is, we can take some of that risk. We can be the risk that allows the banks to go do what they're doing, but at the same time, recognizing that we are going to be the risk capital in that space. And I think even foundations have to be okay with that aspect of it.
Okay. So, another question here is what needs to be built with capital provision? So accounting systems, the legal system, the money transfer system, and whose role is it to build these structures? I mean, in a way, I guess this is connected to what Bert said. I mean, is it the kind of thing where you can just kind of and Alan, you said once the supply is created, the demand will arise. So if we get money to these, make the money available, entrepreneurs are going to rise up and take advantage of it in one form or another. And, you know, there are these interesting studies that look at sort of Somalia in the last, you know, few years where you basically have no real government structure in some ways, and yet you have this sort of strange kind of booming entrepreneurial sort of economy. So, I mean, is it mostly just get the money there and then get out of the way? Or?
No, I mean, in terms of, well, there's two issues. There's top-down accounting systems,
right.
Standardizations, et cetera. There's also, as a business matter,
right.
If SMEs are shown that transparency pays off, you know, obviously we could all count to the cost of informality. If we avoid paying taxes, we normally feel good. But a lot of the kind of companies that we invested in the early mid-90s was high inflation. They didn't even know what their costs were. When we brought in the MIS system and made to one kind of books, we had to show them what the benefit was. When they showed that, when you go to the banks and you get a lending now because there's actual real books, or when you can actually understand that you could save a lot of money if you reduce your inventory or et cetera, and that comes to the bottom line, then we saw entrepreneurs getting it, because, you know, it's the first reaction is, why does all this information, particularly former sort of Central Europe, which is the state is bad, they want my information so they can,
right.
you know, take away whatever. But, you know, so I think you can, on a bottom up, you can definitely show entrepreneurs why it's in their advantage to become modern in terms of the way they
okay.
do their business. Then on the state side, you know, and the traction is there. I can get bank loaning. I can be a supplier to Shell, because Shell wants to see people having relatively transparent kinds of
right.
books and understanding that the business is going to survive. So you have to market that. Entrepreneurs don't necessarily know it. And I think in terms of the countries, again, yes, that can be helpful. I just want to caution people, don't wait for – the excellent is the enemy of the good. I mean, we have these business – doing business things in the IFC, and they're all very good to see that. But if you're going to wait 20 years before Uzbekistan is going to put together a reasonable collateral security law, I mean, you know, there's a lot of people who are going to die in the meantime. So, you know,
right.
I think what you really need to think is, how can you go bottom up? How can you decentralize? How can you actually bet on entrepreneurs who are able to find their way through a system, maybe some publicity, et cetera, while at the same time, hopefully on the donor side, go top down and actually reward those countries or incentivize those countries. I know Alan's on the Millennium Challenge Corporation, certainly something they're trying to do to improve the way
right.
of doing business.
Well, this is a little bit of what you were talking about with being willing to take more risk and accept maybe less reward in that sense. Okay, just a couple more things, and then we're going to have Gail come up. We're going to hear about solutions. So I just want to raise a kind of skeptical – let me just ask a sort of skeptical question, which is, it seems to me there's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem here, specifically when it comes to equity finance and the question of trust. Because one of the great virtues of debt is that you don't really have to trust the person in the exact same way, because you know, if they go out of business, you get to confiscate their property or whatever, and the payments come, et cetera. With equity financing, you constantly run into the problem of, are they self-dealing? What are they doing with my money? Monitoring has to be much more intensive. I mean, if you look at the track record of, for instance, British investors who gave equity money to U.S. companies in the 19th century. I mean, it's just this sort of track record of them wondering, where the heck is my money gone, basically, because it was all kind of wasted in a myriad ways. So is there just a kind of leap of faith you have to take to be an equity investor in the developing world at this point in small to medium enterprises?
I'm happy to say, which I don't get a chance to say very often, I wasn't born at that time. So what I'm interested in is the best of the best.
Okay.
So I'm looking for the ones who accept the things I'm talking about, who'll accept the, I mean, I hope after all this time I know how to put in the right kind of controls. I always said I'm in a minority position in every company I'm involved in, but I put in the kinds of controls that I hope give me some protection. And at the end of the day, you have to make some judgments. But I yes, you can be defeated. But frankly, all these people with debt who put inappropriate structures have to end up restructuring in some way or the other and doing something. And I'm not so sure they get treated any better than we do. And the fact that they have debt and can foreclose, I'm not sure how good it works for them.
Okay.
Although it makes them feel good to get.
They at least know that, right? It's like a false comfort, right? Okay.
And I would certainly just echo where that's going, because you know the debt, you've got currency risk. If I've got a leva 33% in a Bulgarian company and the leva tanks like it did in 1996 from $1,400 to $2,300, I still have 33% of that company.
Right.
But if you had a leva loan, you are definitely, you know, there's nothing there. So the downside in debt in a lot of emerging markets is considerable, let alone trying to sell the collateral if you can find it out in the middle of nowhere or if you can collect it. I think that the issue on the equity, what people have to really understand, and this is particularly for small loans. I mean, I think I think microfinance has done a good job solving that in terms of the various issues. The other thing on equity is, yes, the thing about being in a company for more than 5 or 6 years, you don't know what the future is going to be in 5 or 6 years. If these countries continue to make that movement, you will find a way of exiting. We've made 153 exits. A lot of them are sale backs. About 50% of them are sale back, but a lot of them are trade sales or sales to financial investors, et cetera. The key is, can you work together to make a valuable company?
Right.
And is it in the interest of the entrepreneur to continue to grow such that at the end of the day, you can find a win-win situation for them? I can have rights, I have drag-alongs, all the rest of that, but at the end of the day, you still have to get some consensus, and you've got to find out, okay, this company is going to do better if we exit.
Okay. All right. The last question, which I think is a good one to end with, is what's the single thing, or what can we point to if we come back a year from now? What would let us know that we've actually made progress in closing the financing gap? Now, I mean, obviously, we're not going to close the financing gap in a year, but what would be a sign of progress? What could we look to and say that's actually a benchmark that we want to hit in some way?
Well, I think that one of the biggest challenges is for the shareholders of the development finance institutions, the people who make decisions at the Google Foundation and people like that, and I think they're not, I don't mean to pick on, just happen to be so here. but to accept the fact that what we're talking about here today makes sense and that it's worthwhile to try to start this kind of a process going. And if we came back here a year from now, and frankly, there can't be enough equity projects started, the one I'm personally working on is in East Africa for Tanzania, Uganda, and Kenya, is for $45 million. I mean, there's no competition between Bird or anyone else. I wish we had 10 of those, because this kind of business, you don't do it yourself. You like to do it with partnerships.
Right.
And if we could get some of these things jump-started in Latin America, in East Asia, Southeast Asia, and certainly my personal passion is Africa, we could use them all over the place, because if this model starts to work, you can do it every place. And that would be very hopeful if next year we could point to several of these getting started.
Just getting started, right. Sonal?
Same. I mean, I think, and similarly, if we could walk away with having made some investments, come back and say we've tried and we're leveraging some investments, that doesn't mean just go out and find any fund that's out there and invest in it, but bet on the good ones and see which ones are out there that have been successful. CEIF has been very successful in Eastern Europe, Latin America. You know, bet on some of the good ones, try them and see what happens, because my bet is that there's a lot of great entrepreneurs in many different countries, and if we can give them the chance, we will be able to come back and say, what happened is we've created X number of jobs, we've created X number of new businesses, and many more players from the capital markets are coming in now and are taking that position. I would be very happy to exit.
Okay. Bert?
Yeah, I'd like to add, and I completely echo all that said before by Sonal and by Alan, is I'd like to see more funds that are structured where there's not only return component, but there's also some quantifiable development impact. I think if we can organize so that socially responsible investors are not, there's only two ways. There's another question we didn't get to, which is how can private enterprise investors actually get in? You have to find a way to either attract people who get more than just the utility of having a 10% return, if that's what's going to happen, but also are going to take, whether psychic income or whatever, being able to say, I've held these people to account and they did what they said they were going to do. Or you have to devise other
Can I interrupt you one thing, because I don't want to get...
Yeah.
Very important component in all this, I think, is to attract some local money in these different communities.
Yeah, what I was wondering about.
Call angel money, to get them vested and co-opted into the system, and I think it's very possible.
No. In fact, we've done it in Colombia, Peru, and in Afghanistan. So,
okay.
There's there. But anyway, so to wrap up that final issue is when people are beginning to focus on what the SMEs can do, and when people are holding people to account, then I think a new form of development instrument can exist, which is something we can all be proud of, which we can actually track to see what's going on, and we're much more aware of.
Okay. All right, Gail.
I hate to interrupt because I kind of think you all will have it solved if we give you 15 more minutes. And financed. Let me share with you some findings from the tables, and you all have these here. But in terms of solutions, you all talked about creating institutions to defray risk, for example, using a first loss guarantee model. A second one was sponsor an awareness campaign to stress that the return on investment may be lower, but social returns are high. Alan, you talked about that. If you knew you'd created 10,000 jobs, your profit was a bit lower and took a bit longer, that would be a great thing. This is one of the most important pieces, I think, in the whole equation. It came up yesterday in terms of talking about the need for development education and for people to understand that we're investing in people and not just providing relief and looking for big profits. Reform the role of the international organizations in the financial system. I think you all agreed with Sunil that could be done very quickly. But to get development agencies not to be so focused on immediate returns and tangible impacts that can be reported to taxpayers, donors, or members of Congress in 12 months, because that's not the way human communities grow and develop. Again, this is a big task. I think if you all had it sorted out by CGI next year, it'd be great. But more seriously, it's the kind of thing we've really got to focus on. Those of us who've been in government know it's impossible to use government capital for this kind of thing just for that reason. Think beyond capital. The need for mentorship, vocational training, local business guidance, accounting systems, and legal infrastructure. This is tied to what you were just saying about finding the domestic capital, but consistent with all the other sessions in this track, we've talked about the need to have all of these things. You've got to have the capacity to use the tools if they can be created. Encourage the development of local equity capital to partner with local investors. Encourage existing institutions to focus on property rights and taxation. I think this is an interesting point. And Bert, you mentioned this about taxation. The amount of time that is spent by donors and others telling governments they need to reform their tax system this way or that way. I would argue that a dialogue between a lot of governments and potential investors about that might well yield some different results, because it's nobody lecturing anybody on what to do. It's talking about, we want to invest here, and here's some things that would make it more possible. Promote accountability by funding SME rating agencies. A really good idea to build that trust we talked about. Promote local role models. Alan, the tables are willing to do what you say. Finally, some gems. Franchise SMEs. Prepare a viable, repeatable business plan for expats to execute. It's a really good idea. It ties back to what Ian Davis said yesterday about scalability. You can get one great SME, but how do you think big scale at the same time? Create an international small business administration to focus on SMEs in the developing world. Again, we've had reference to the SBA here. Similar models around the world, another very good idea. Finally, develop an SME laboratory. Team up people in venture capital, education, people on the ground, identify an entrepreneur, and let that team go to work. I think that's, again, a really good idea about how to bring the right people to the table and move this forward. So I will turn it now back to you to react to this, and thank you all very much for giving us not only good ideas to follow up the discussion, but also because we're going to be summing up in the plenary this afternoon. So thank you.
Okay. We've got about 3 minutes, and then we're going to hear...
No? We gave you more because we like you.
Oh, you gave me... Oh, I thought I was subtracting 8 from that. No?
No, this panel is so good.
apparently we've upped your time.
So I got the full 11? Okay. Can hear the groan from the audience. So. I want to eat lunch, I'm sure. But, okay, so, well, let me ask, I don't know if this is a rude question or not. Which of these solutions do you all think are most immediately appealing to you, actually?
Can we get some questions from the audience? Is that possible?
Well, that's what we had earlier. This was, and in a way, that's what these are, right? In a way, that's
right,
what
all
these
right,
are.
All right.
So which of these is most, do you think makes
I would tell you, this is
sense?
A very, I can't, it's the first one I can say I've been here for two and a half, this is, I'm going to use these slides.
These are good.
This is really, this summarizes the story. It really does.
Well, can you talk, I actually, the first one, which is something that Sonal had mentioned, something along these lines, creating institutions to defray risk, a first loss guarantee model. I mean, that's an intriguing concept, right? I mean, one of the characteristics of a developed economy is that there are lots of instruments, financial and otherwise, that help risk to be defrayed, to be diversified, et cetera. Is that something that you can imagine, that we can create those sorts of institutions in developing countries easily, or is that a huge task?
I think it's truly possible. I know ICICI Bank in India is already looking at doing some of this. I think there are local institutions. I think there are international financial institutions. I know we've been talking to a few ourselves to figure out how we can partner with them in creating them. It just requires imagination and a willingness to go try something. And I think now there is more of an opportunity to think about that, and especially as people are seeing great interest in SMEs, great interest in investments in these funds. But while you can invest in some number of funds, you also need to figure out how to scale in different ways and how can we get banks and others to take more of these risk models. And I know I think this morning the president announced a political risk insurance facility in Palestine, Palestinian territories. Those types of things help, but it requires investment too. It can't be just the risk facility. It's got to take investment. So we've got to do a bit of everything. It can't be just, the risk facility itself will be enough or the investments itself will be enough. I think if we can, foundations like ourselves and others who are willing to put in some risk capital can do some more of that.
We should give credit to OPIC. OPIC is now focused in this area, very, very much focused. Also, something I forgot to say, I saw Jim sitting here from Starbucks. When I started mentioning these role models, believe me, Howard Schultz is a role model, and he said with three coffee shops. I can attest to it because I have the bad record of having turned down Howard Schultz when he had three coffee shops, because my wife and I decided you didn't need another coffee shop in New York. So before he says it or Howard says it, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
I make mistakes all the time.
Now, what about
funny thing. We got pension money and insurance company in Peru and Colombia to come in. We first offered some first loss guarantee or some bottom end. That turned out to be not so popular for them because they were afraid that meant that we thought we were going to lose money. Sometimes what you want to do is to have somebody come in and say, okay, I will only take my capital back, and the return on top of the capital will go there. In other words, goose the return. So there's a positive way of looking at it and a negative way of looking at it. And in some places, depending upon what capital you want to attract, the positive way is better. DCA, the Development Credit Authority by AID, does a lot of this sort of 50% sharing of the downside. It's not that easy for them to sell that facility out there, and I think it's because of those reasons.
Huh. One of the things we haven't talked about that you might want to discuss, and because I saw Starbucks here, I don't know how many major corporations here, but we haven't talked about what the role that corporations can have, because major corporations have skill base. They have linkages where they can be extremely helpful in partnering and stimulating the development of high growth SMEs, not just the suppliers who do the janitorial services or paint and do the carpentry, but who really can become world class businesses, and they can be helpful in either lending their people, seconding them to other activities, and help these things in getting started.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I had actually, when Bert and I were talking in the interregnum, we were talking, and I was asking him whether or not you need big corporations in a country for them. I mean, is that maybe not a precondition, but does that really give a huge boost to SMEs because, either talent, people leaving those companies to go work for them, or their customers, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously, in a lot of developing countries, there aren't even really necessarily big successful corporations in some ways. But you seem to think that it wasn't necessary, that there were examples.
I mean, of course, let's be provocative.
Sure.
But I mean,
yeah,
because clearly if you've got large corporations who are potential customers who do potentially help on regulations and are not using, you know, a buddy-buddy system, in some countries you've got the large corporation and the government, you know, conspire against everybody else.
Right. Right.
So, but I know in certain places like Central Europe, there are a lot of countries that didn't have any big corporations. There were some that were privatized, but you would find a lot of SMEs who were serving needs that had not been met before, whether they were for chicken feed, which is, you know, used to be by the state. Now you can improve the chicken feed and you can bring that out to the people. You would find lots of people, once you start owning those chicken, instead of having them there on secondment by the state poultry side, you know, once you start owning those chicken, you'd be surprised how people are looking for, how can I get more productivity? How can I stop trucks running them over? You know, how can I do heating? So there's the question is, do you have enough base of business that can support growth? And to the extent that large corporations are there to help, that's terrific. To the extent that people can see productivity increases, then they're not necessarily for that.
Okay.
Supply chains matter. I mean, whether it's that you're feeding into the government supply chain or you're feeding into a large corporate supply chain, where there aren't large corporations, there's large government.
Okay.
And if there are ways to get the buyers of those supply chains to think a little bit differently, or if there are ways to organize groups to feed into supply chains, which is, I think, where Alan was going, it helps. And Starbucks certainly has done a fantastic job of that. And I know TechnoServe has been working with various corporations with coffee and other ways of doing that. But I think if we can figure out how to get those supply chains and feed into the trade facilitation facilities,
right,
different types of supply chains, because it's a market and it's a supply market that you can now feed into that we don't think about sometimes.
But that's why globalization is great, because Starbucks doesn't have to be in Kenya. But what has to happen is that you organize a supply chain. I know Root Capital, I think what Harold is doing with some of the grassroots organizations trying to get into the Starbucks. And it's terrific when some of the corporations are willing to go down, understand the story, and provide that suction, which really allows those markets to be organized. I agree.
Okay. So one of the other solutions was Think Beyond Capital, talking about the need for mentorship, vocational training, local business guidance. What I want to ask here is, to what degree is this a kind of, you sprinkle the seeds in this, and the seeds being capital in this sense, and then we can just assume that basically entrepreneurship in one way or another will spring up? Or do you actually need a kind of transformation of business education, of a kind of culture of entrepreneurship, et cetera?
Absolutely cannot. And that's why technical assistance is a component of every one of these funds we're talking about. If you don't, what people have learned and the mistakes that were made is they just put together capital funds in the 80s and 90s and had some very bad experience because they didn't reinforce these entrepreneurs. I mean, you can't expect them to have every talent. It'd be great. But to have a technical assistance, which is a nonprofit component, grant-making type of capacity, is very helpful. The other thing is mentorship goes along with corporates, and it goes along with what I said about having local angels involved, because that's a great place to get
right.
your mentorship, and you get them invested and co-opted into making a success and helping, because local knowledge is absolutely critical. I mean, for example, what I'm talking about and what I know Bert's talking about, and anyone who's smart is talking about having local people, not people from
right.
New York, Washington, or London doing this. This has got to be indigenous people who know the territory.
Well, because, I mean, that's one of the questions I was sort of thinking about as we were looking at these, is this question of having local people must help in the sense of getting around the problem of the outside Sharpies coming in to kind of, you know, take away basically take a huge chunk of the company and then walk away with it. I mean, there must be some dimension in which working with local people helps build trust with equity investors.
Well, we have local investment committees where we have leading business people who are recognized as being honest, who are recognized as having growth, et cetera. And any investment goes through them,
okay.
as well as through sometimes investment committees with investors in them. But what happens is when we then talk to an SME, again, there's this trust factor.
Right.
If Julio Manuel is on your investment committee, he's a good guy, everybody knows he's a good guy, then that's certainly a big positive. So I think you're right. You have to make sure there's enough local there. There is a benefit from having an international work so that people think, okay, well, I can understand what's happening in globalization. Are those lessons going to be transferred? Have you got access to large corporations where my headroom for growth is going to expand? But I think that, you know, the trust issue requires local people on the ground, committed people on the ground. The one last thing on technical questions I just want to say is make sure it's not totally free. In other words, make sure that the entrepreneur pays part of it. If there's a co-payment, then I think it's much better. And oftentimes it needs to be integrated with the partners in such a way as to say, well, we'll do this. It'll be partly paid by the company, but partly on the TA. Works much, much better.
Okay.
The only thing on the local piece is also it helps with deal flow. People that know their markets. It's sometimes what happens, and I know in past funds that have been created, it's somebody that doesn't even live in the country that is running, is the manager of the fund, but they don't know, they don't have the trust within the community to go find where the deals are. People are coming to them. So having someone local makes a huge difference in deal flow, sourcing, and understanding and knowing where to go. I mean, a country like India, you need to know four states because the country in itself is a problem.
Right.
And trying to find deal flow all over. But if you can find people that know that and can maneuver within those markets, it makes a huge difference.
Okay. All right. I think we'll wrap it up then. Thank you very much. It was really fascinating, I thought. And both challenging and hopeful, I think, which is probably the way the real world is. So now I'm going to introduce Jeffrey Wright, who is going to present the commitment certificates. Jeffrey, as most of you probably know, won a Tony Award for his stage work in Angels in America. He's won a Golden Globe and an Emmy for the HBO version of Angels in America. And it says he rose to fame. He was very famous for his portrayal of Basquiat in the Julian Schnabel film. He was recently in the last Bond movie, Casino Royale, and is filming a movie called The Visiting with Oliver Hirschbiegel. What I did not know, but which many of you probably are familiar with also, is that he is CEO for TAIA, a company undertaking economic development in West Africa with a focus on Sierra Leone. And so he's now going to come up and present the commitments. Thank you, Jeff.
Before I announce these commitments, I'd like to just express my real gratitude to President Clinton and everyone who coordinates and contributes to the CGI for rejuvenating me these past three Septembers. It's, as you heard, my experience wrestling with these issues relates to sleep to my experiences in Sierra Leone. And by the way, I think we should all in this room take note of the recent elections in Sierra Leone just 2 weeks ago. People of that country made an extraordinary statement. Just a few years out of a 10-year civil war, to have succeeded with their second peaceful and fair election, I think, is something that deserves to be honored with direct investment. What I've found these past few years is that I've been banging my head against the all-too-pervasive thought that capital is agnostic to these social concerns. I've had folks repeat that to me as though it's some kind of fundamental Newtonian constant. You know, capital's agnostic to this, so therefore move on. I don't have a lot of good things to say about actors, but one thing that I know we do is reimagine realities. It's how we make our living. So I am really grateful to all of you for reimagining this reality and for taking action. So I want to invite the following folks up and announce their commitments along these paths. Michael Carey, please come to the stage, who's executive chairman of Jacob Fruitful Food Group. And the organizations involved in this commitment are Brands for Food, Trade Links, Irish Aid, which is group under the Irish government, and the commitment is providing professional management expertise to ethical food producers and cooperatives in developing countries in order to increase access to export markets for their output, and that's a $1 million commitment. And through collaboration with Trade Links and the Irish government, the Jacob Fruitfield Food Group will establish a unique Heart of Africa brand to be sold in Irish grocery stores, providing food entrepreneurs and developing countries with a new export outlet within a strong national economy. The Heart of Africa brand has been created with the pro bono work of the marketing services suppliers to Jacob Fruitfield Food Group, including packaging designers, advertising agencies, and PR firms. And with the launch this past year in Ireland, the intent is to replicate the Heart of Africa brand in seven new countries. So, next, please, Albina Ruiz, Executive Director of Ciudad Saludable, and I managed to see some of her presentation yesterday, and it was very exciting to see folks who are addressing these issues from the root. I think it's important that those perspectives be included in our dialogue. This commitment is improving the working conditions of informal recyclers and contributing to the environmental recovery of Latin America through selective collection and the reuse of solid waste. It's a $6.8 million commitment. The group will work to bring dignity to the little-known informal recycling and waste scavenging industry and contribute to the environmental recovery of seven Latin American regions through selective waste collection and waste reusal programs. The program includes an innovative four-part strategy, including a community-based waste management system, coordination with relevant public agencies, public information and education campaigns, and the mobilization of the support of a broad array of sources. This commitment will create 3,000 stable scavenging jobs to highlight the heavy environmental impact of waste-related activities. Next, please, Byron August. And Lynn Taliento. Byron is a director of McKinsey, and Lynn is a principal at McKinsey. They here? Yes.
You're taking a long way.
Yeah. And the commitment is researching, analyzing, and showcasing innovation in public-private social partnerships to show how and why these partnerships are successful.
Thank you.
And There's no dollar figure here, so I'm assuming this is open-ended. This commitment will create a blueprint for world business, government, and social sector leaders to aid influential individuals and organizations in developing cross-sector partnerships. The concluding report will be novel in its focus and on the possible implications that innovation has for public, private, and social sector leaders. By successfully analyzing the nature of innovation in cross-sector partnerships, McKinsey will disseminate the knowledge mechanism with the potential of increasing access to capital and economic development to thousands of people worldwide. Lastly, Jim Donald, President, CEO of Starbucks, and also Chandra Taylor, who is your responsibility? Corporate social responsibility for Starbucks. And this commitment is supporting the African coffee industry through direct purchasing and on-site assistance, complemented by expertise sharing. The value of this is a million dollar commitment. To aid the emerging African coffee industry, Starbucks will increase its regional coffee imports and set up an on-site farmer support center to provide technical assistance and credit access to aspiring coffee growers. Starbucks sees tremendous potential and unique opportunity for the future of Africa's coffee farmers and will work with growers on the ground to help increase productivity and sustainability. Over 2 years' time, Starbucks will double the amount of coffee it purchases from East Africa and earmark $1 million for credit access to farmers.
Special word of thanks to Jeffrey Wright. He's a man who's passionate about his acting, but he is equally, if not more, passionate about the work he does on behalf of West Africa. And we are deeply moved by that and inspired by that. And if you want to make your investments following the elections in Sierra Leone, see him right after this panel. Let me thank our panelists, and most importantly, let me thank all of you. This is the last of five panels in the poverty track this year. We will have a final plenary, which is usually a pretty good show, including because we have to summarize all of this in 2.5 minutes. But then President Clinton does his Clintonian changing the world thing, which is a quite powerful thing, I think, for all of us and captures the essence of why we're here. But most important, and quite sincerely, I want to thank you. Alan, you said when you saw what came back from the table discussions that the plan was there, the ideas are there. And I think it's something we've seen grow better and better with each year of CGI, that we get this back and forth going where we've got experts and people with experience and real doers on the ground who marry up their ideas with people who come from all walks of life to figure out how we can find the solutions. And I think you've done a stupendous job. One of the things I will do with my team here is pass on to the folks who do this full-time all year some of the ideas you've presented as things we can push out to the CGI member community and see if we can't get some people to say, hey, that's a good idea, and I'll do that. So I thank all of you. And finally, I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking two groups of people. First, the table facilitators and theme team in the back in America Speaks. These are the people that make this dialogue possible. And secondly, the two people who have actually really pulled this track together this year, who are my deputies, friends, and accomplices in making me look good when, as I say, they've done a tremendous job, David Auerbach and John Lyman. So thank you. Go take a break, and then please join us for the plenary. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, lunch is served outside the session room. The closing afternoon session will begin at 2 p.m.